We find ourselves once again talking about Obamacare, thanks, no, not to a Supreme Court case, but a corporate announcement this morning. Also, how we know what we know about ISIS and its money. And Troy Carter, arguably, although he would deny this, the hardest working man in show business. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 19th of November, Thursday, I believe. Great as always to have you with us, everybody. United Health Group is the biggest health insurance company in the country. So when it speaks, people listen. This morning, the company spoke loud and perhaps clear about the Affordable Care Act. United Health figures to lose, they said, $425 million selling insurance coverage plans on ACA exchanges and is thinking about whether to pull out of those exchanges entirely down the road. $425 million is a whole lot of money, no matter how big you are. And today's news rekindles the debate about the long-term viability of that law. But Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports from the Health Desk at WHYY, the announcement might actually say more about United Health than it does about the ACA.
Editorials, Twitter, and cable TV, they're all full of doom and gloom today.
This is very damning for ACA. Very damning.
That's Jim Cramer this morning on CNBC. To ACA opponents, United's announcement is further proof that insurance sold on the exchanges attracts too many sick and expensive consumers. The argument goes premiums will just get higher and higher, insurers' losses will mount, and dum-da-dum-dum.
I mean, I'm hearing some people saying, oh my God, death spiral. You know, that's absolutely wrong.
Jonathan Gruber is an economist at MIT and an architect of the ACA. Even if United does pull out, other major carriers, including Aetna and Anthem, have said in recent weeks they're in, for now. Insurers expect several new regulations to drive healthier consumers onto the exchanges in several years. Northwestern's Limor Daphne says United taking a hit doesn't mean insurers can't make money.
In the early stages of any marketplace, companies are figuring it out, and there are winners and there are losers. And United is signaling, hey, we're one of those who lost.
While the company's announcement may sound like sour grapes to some, it highlights what the industry considers a major problem. When the ACA was established, the government created a financial safety net to support insurers as they entered the exchange business. Whether it's co-ops closing or the nation's largest insurer struggling, Claire Cruising with the trade group AHIP says it shows the net isn't as strong as it needs to be.
And the result of that is instability, coverage disruptions, and serious challenges to the affordable coverage that consumers depend on.
Insurers would like to see more federal dollars go to cover some of their losses. In turn, it's more likely they'll stay in the exchanges, creating the price competition we all want. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
In the halls of power of Washington, D.C. today, the House of Representatives voted overwhelmingly, as in veto-proof overwhelmingly, to effectively stop a program aimed at resettling thousands of Syrian refugees in this country. Since Paris, there's been mounting concern about who's getting into the United States, concern not just about refugees. Some lawmakers now want to tighten something called the Visa Waiver Program. It's a program that makes it easier for people from almost 40 countries, most of them allied with the United States, to come here. And for us to go there, it should be said. One proposal being bandied about would make people who travel to Syria and Iraq ineligible for those waivers. Another would introduce a waiting period. The U.S. travel industry, as you might imagine, doesn't much like the idea. Marketplace's Andy Euler has the story.
Most of the people using the visa waiver program are tourists from one of the 38 countries on the OK list. They don't have to apply to get a travel visa to come here, which can be a lengthy and expensive process. Jonathan Grella is with the U.S. Travel Association. He says international travelers spend a lot of money here, close to $200 billion last year.
The harder we make it for people to enter the country, the less likely they're going to choose America over somewhere else. And that might sound like an okay thing today to some, but obviously that comes with very severe economic consequences.
Even so, some lawmakers say continuing the program without changing it could make it easier for terrorists to get through. Nathan Sales is a law professor at Syracuse University.
The visa waiver program requires all member countries to provide the United States with important intelligence information about known and suspected terrorists.
That requirement was brought in after 9/11. Sales recognizes there are gaps in travel security, but says new rules aren't the answer.
Strengthen the security features of the program even more. Fully implement the information sharing agreements and agree to share additional information about airline passenger data.
Some countries are more willing to share information than others, citing privacy concerns. The travel industry agrees security is key. People won't come to America if they don't think it's safe. But Shane Downey with the Global Business Travel Association says overreaction could be costly.
It would discourage people from coming into the United States to do business, is what it would do. They would find another location to go to that's not as difficult to go into.
Some lawmakers say easy access means more business, but also more risk. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Wall Street today broke even. Basically, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've been talking a lot this week about where ISIS gets its money and how it operates. The quick and dirty version of the money story goes like this. The Treasury Department figures ISIS stole somewhere between $500 million and $1 billion with a B dollars from banks in 2014. And that earlier this year, it was making about $40 million a month from the sale of oil. There is also good old-fashioned extortion and the taxes it levies on people and businesses in the territory it controls. You throw in looting antiquities, kidnapping for ransom, and the list of ISIS revenue sources is long and diverse. Now, how do we know what we know about the items on that list? Tracking terrorist money has changed a lot in the past 15 years, it turns out. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has that story.
Juan Zarate started work at the Treasury Department the summer before 9/11. After the attacks, he was one of the people trying to figure out how to follow the money in the fight against terrorism. He helped set up the Treasury's Office of Terrorism and Financial Intelligence.
When you get to your desk in the morning, what do you do? How do you do this?
Well, to follow the money, what you need in front of you is data. You need information.
Zarate's now with a private advisory firm, the Financial Integrity Network. He says with groups like Al-Qaeda, we got used to using financial tools and sanctions from afar to shut terrorists out of the global financial system. Now, it's harder.
You can't push a button magically in New York or London or Washington to constrict their resources.
ISIS makes money from the territory it controls, from taxing goods that cross its border to selling oil. So the approach has to change.
The terrorist financing of 2015 requires on-the-ground intelligence gathering in environments that we do not control, requires dislodgement of groups from resources and populations that they lord over and profit from. And it really becomes a very much a physical effort.
It's a whole different approach than looking at bank transfers, wire transfers.
Luis Shelley is the director of the Terrorism, Transnational Crime, and Corruption Center at George Mason University.
We need to increasingly focus on the relationship of crime and terrorism so that we don't see these as two separate problems.
She says these days, there isn't much terrorism that doesn't involve some other crime.
For example, one of the terrorists who attacked Charlie Hebdo was trading in counterfeit sneakers. The terrorist who attacked on the Thalys train between Brussels and Paris, he was a small-scale drug trafficker.
Shelley says terrorism investigators need to work better with those focusing on illegal trade or drugs or human trafficking. So yeah, you're still following money transfers, but also mapping the network of counterfeit sneaker suppliers.
And you begin to see the convergence of these activities because the terrorists are generally functioning like diversified business people.
Shelley says both the White House and the UN have called for prioritizing the links between crime and terrorism. She thinks New York and LA are already doing this well, but nationally and internationally?
There's still not enough cooperation.
It is an ongoing issue.
Ray Kelly is the former commissioner of the NYPD, now vice chairman of K2 Intelligence.
But you have to stress that the amount of money needed for a terrorist event is sometimes shockingly small.
So following the money is a tool, not the tool, says Matthew Levitt with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
Sad fact is that there are lots and lots of ways to make, raise, move, access, launder money. Sometimes people assume that following the money will be a panacea, and it's powerful, yes, but it's no panacea.
He says it's extremely unlikely that we could completely shut down funding for a given group or bankrupt them completely. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
There's a new study out from the National Bureau of Economic Research that says, basically, the robots have finally won. Not one like the big win a la Terminator, but research does suggest algorithms might be better at picking the right employee than hiring managers are. Rebecca Greenfield wrote about the study for Bloomberg Business. Rebecca, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Should hiring managers be afraid, very afraid of these algorithms? What do you think?
Hiring managers should not be afraid of hiring algorithms. I think that they should think of them as their friends. They can help them hire.
That's what all the people who say the robots are coming say. What exactly did the study find, I guess, is the first question.
This study looked at hiring managers who listened to robots and hiring managers who didn't listen to robot recommendations. And it found that the managers who didn't listen to the robot recommendations picked worse candidates. So basically, wow. The robots, they know who is good at their job and who's going to stay at the job.
Well, so that's the thing, right? Define worse candidates. Are bad candidates the ones who leave early? Is that the metric here?
The metric here is retention. That's because it's pretty easy to measure, but also employers care about that because it's expensive to replace people, train new people. So they like to keep people around. They did try to measure productivity, and they did some work on that, but their findings weren't as conclusive.
What human failing do these algorithms correct for then?
Bias. I mean, there might be some overt bias, people not wanting to hire people of a certain race or gender, but also people just think that they're a better judge of character than they actually are.
Yeah, it's. I'm going to go with my gut. I like this person. I can spot this person who's got potential, right? And the algorithms, come on, computers can't do that.
Exactly. And you might bond with someone on your favorite hobby and think that that's a good reason to have them around the office.
How far do you think we are, or do the researchers, I guess, think we are from these things being widely adopted? Because honestly, there's that whole, you know, the robot ate my job thing in which, you know, they become sort of not our friends.
I think they're already being used by a lot of companies. Google famously uses algorithms to decide who to hire. So I don't think we're that far away from companies who, you know, want to hire the best people, keep people around as long as possible, save money on their retention and turnover costs. It makes sense for them to invest in something like this.
The robots are coming. Rebecca Greenfield covers work culture at Bloomberg Business. Rebecca, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up.
I think it's overstated. You know, you can't make an artist like Lady Gaga.
He's being modest, I think, but all right. Troy Carter straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Another flat-ish day on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrial is off 4 points, almost nothing percentage-wise, 17,732 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ off a single point. We're not even going to dignify that with a percentage comment, 5,073. The S&P 500 shed 2 points, 0.1%, 2,081. All right, I got a half a minute here. Let's play a little good, not good, okay? Not good when you take your unicorn tech company public but are forced to cut the opening share price. We're talking Square here, the payment processor. Good when trading starts and shares pop 45%. Match Group, the day's other tech IPO, it popped 22% today. Also not good when a big investor tells you not to sell your stake in another company, say Alibaba, and instead tells you instead to get rid of your core business. That would be Yahoo, the latest advice from a big hedge fund trying to wring maximum value, that is, money out of its Yahoo shares. Yahoo down 1%, which is getting off easy, really. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The companies and regulators that make up the North American electricity system, that is the power grid, in other words, are at the tail end of their version of the kinds of stress tests that the Federal Reserve does on banks. The whole point with these things is to simulate reality, which in the past couple of years has meant anticipating more and different kinds of threats to the power grid than ever before. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong is on this one.
Right now, the lights are out for thousands of North Americans. Virtually, that is. That's the whole point of Grid X3, the third time a set of pretend disasters has come upon the electric industry. The latest attacks came yesterday and today.
Most of the attack scenarios peaked on the first day.
George Masters is an engineer at the grid equipment provider Schweitzer Engineering Labs.
And in the following day, we're seeing some copycat episodes, and we're seeing utilities start to restore communications.
The exact details of the war game are closely held, but they likely include a simulated aerial attack. That happened in real life in Quebec this year, taking out a critical East Coast transmission line. Brian Harrell at Navigant Consulting helped develop this grid exercise.
We do know that it involved a single-engine airplane dropping material onto the high-voltage lines.
A different vulnerability being tested is emergency communication. Last month, a utility in Ohio fended off a cyber attack. But Harrell says an instant response from the feds, who could have protected the larger system, never came.
The governments of North America may be ill-prepared to process this threat information and actually do anything about it.
Energy is one of the most hacked industries. Russian hackers have penetrated the American grid, and a virus reportedly sent by the U.S. and Israel has sabotaged Iran's nuclear facilities. But spycraft is not the big issue for keeping the lights on. Cybersecurity software designer Robert M. Lee.
The top two threats to the grid are, weather events and squirrels getting in transformers.
He says the new simulated attacks on the grid combine nature and physical attacks and cyber. So, after 3 tests in 5 years, how has the grid responded?
We are getting better, but my concern is we have a lot of ground to make up, and we have very sophisticated adversaries.
And the question, he says, is, are we getting better fast enough? In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
I was in New York City a couple of weeks ago for a couple of different things, one of which was the Fast Company Innovation Festival, specifically an onstage interview with Troy Carter. Carter is one of the best-known music managers on the planet. He has managed, or he's broken, as they say in the business, Meghan Trainor, John Legend, and Lady Gaga, to name just a couple you might have heard of. He's turned himself into a tech investor as well, with stakes in Uber, Spotify, and Warby Parker, among others, and he runs Atom Factory, a cutting-edge talent management company. So I sat down with him on stage in New York, which we have turned into our latest installment of Conversations from the Corner Office.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
One of the most interesting things about Troy Carter is his backstory. He dropped out of high school when he was 17 back in 1990 to try to make it as a rapper. So I started by asking him how much of where he has gotten comes from where he came from.
You know, I think it all comes from there. You know, I think it's more hustle than anything else. You know, I grew up West Philadelphia, born and raised. And but I grew up carrying crates of records for Will Smith and those guys. I thought I was going to be a rapper as a kid and used to hop the train down to Jazzy Jeff's studio for like 6 months straight, waiting outside of the studio for the big break. And one day we got in the studio and played our demo for Will and Jeff, and quickly learned that we weren't that good. but Will and his partner, James Lasseter, kind of saw some potential in our hustle and kind of took me under their wing.
You're a guy who's virtually every article about you, somewhere in the first paragraph says, he's the guy who made Lady Gaga, who discovered Lady Gaga and turned her into what she has become. Does that make you crazy?
No, I think that's an overstatement, by the way. It's like,
well, that's what the article said, man. But, I mean, whether or not you made Lady Gaga.
Don't believe everything you on the internet, unless it's TMZ. They get the real scoop. No, I think it's overstated. You know, you can't make an artist like Lady Gaga. That's like saying, you know, LeBron James's high school coach made LeBron James. Hmm. You know, LeBron James made LeBron James. And I feel the same thing about her.
What's your skill then? Is your skill finding talent and identifying it? Or is your skill taking talent and growing it?
I think my skill set is, I think I really understand people, and I think I'm a really good problem solver. When young artists come to us, and I think I have a better ability than a layman to recognize talent, but I wouldn't say that I can hear a good record and make a good record great. There's only a few people that can do that, right?
Right.
But you partner with people who know how to make records great, and my job is to be able to take that and get it to the promised land.
I don't want to stay on Gaga for too long, but you did some really creative and innovative things when you broke her, right? Social media and all of that.
We didn't know what we were doing.
That was the question.
So what happened was we had a lot of experience in urban music. And it was a certain pattern that you would use to develop and break acts, right?
Right.
You would do 3 or 4 shows a night. You know, you would have a street team in place that would go out and pass out flyers. And we literally took that same strategy and broke Gaga with that same exact strategy. Radio went and played the music.
Yeah.
And, you know, they basically told us it was this 4-on-the-floor dance music. And at that time, Facebook was just coming out of .edu, YouTube was just rising, Twitter was just rising, and we were able to kind of catch this cultural wave and this sort of artistic democracy. And also, you saw the shift from like Rolling Stone kind of controlling the review process to Perez Hilton,
right.
You know, all of a sudden being like the music influencer. And he became more important to us than like even getting a Rolling Stone cover at that point.
So technology enabled a lot of what you did, right? It enabled a lot of what happened. I wonder now what your viewpoint is on technology and the business and value of music, because my 17-year-old won't buy a record now. He's like, Dad, I can get it on Spotify and I have to listen to a couple commercials. So has technology devalued music?
Not at all, because the difference is you'll probably buy a $57 ticket to that concert for your son.
Well, he will, because he knows lawns.
Yeah, but he'll buy the $57 ticket versus the $1.29 song, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, the way we're projecting out right now, music is bigger than it's ever been before. You know, when you turn on television commercials, it's going to be music. It's going to be music in the background. You're going to have artists endorsing products. Spotify is probably close to 100 million users on the platform.
And we should say you're an investor in Spotify.
Yes, I'm an investor in Spotify, Pandora, Apple Music.
Yep.
The ecosystem's huge. You got all of these things, and going through the devaluation of the actual music file, when you look at the actual value there, to me, the Beatles catalog should be worth more than Spotify, right?
Yeah.
And Spotify is worth more than the entire company, let alone just that single catalog. You know, so I think the industry's done a very poor job in terms of value capture.
Last one, and then I got to get you guys out of here. When was the last time you failed?
I fail all the time. Yeah, it's pretty regular. no, you know what?
We should all fail like you.
I think a lot of times, you know, your rights become louder than your wrongs, and you're able to bury your dead very quietly. But the reality is, you know, for every Meghan Trainor and Lady Gaga and John Legend, you got artists that don't become quite so successful or whatever. Sometimes you just don't get the timing right. Sometimes you made a bad decision. So it's like, you know, just being able to assess it and not getting too high with the highs, not getting too low with the lows. You're gonna keep failing if you don't take those failures seriously. So I think you absolutely visit that place, but you can't choose to live there.
Troy Carter, ladies and gentlemen.
Troy Carter doesn't just manage talent, he manages money as well. More from him about the venture capital firm he started and his thoughts on tech investing. You can hear the full interview on our Corner Office podcast. It is on our website or wherever you get your podcasts. Final note on the way out today about which, check back with me in 118 years, all right? Seriously, the World Economic Forum Global Gender Gap Report out yesterday says that based on current trends, women aren't going to start making the same pay as men for doing the same job, this is worldwide, until the year 2133, which is staggering, honestly. Iceland, Norway, and Finland are the top 3 countries for gender pay parity. Yemen, Pakistan, and Syria, in the news for other reasons, obviously, are at the bottom of that list. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 4 points today, basically nothing percentage-wise. The NASDAQ basically flat as well. The S&P 500 down 2 points. about a tenth of 1%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. APM, this is.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.